Now that it takes 2.5 incomes to maintain one household, few have time enough to eat at home. And so today we pause to ask, where can we find time enough for food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,035th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends way over there in not-so-gay Paris, who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, wherever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the board. Hello, Jason.
Pleasure to be here.
So, Jason, do you have enough time to prepare your own meals at home?
Man, on a day like today, it is tight. It comes real close.
Okay. Folks, we live in what we all believe to be one of the most advanced civilizations in the history of the world. But we do not eat like we do. Instead of sitting down to enjoy a civilized meal of carefully prepared foods with family and friends, we are more likely to grab, gobble, and run like primitives in a primeval forest. Wait. I had to take that back. A few years ago, I had the privilege of sharing some meals with the Shipibo people who live along the Rio Ucayali, which is a headwater of the Amazon. The Shipibo had lots of time with which to dine, and so our meals were long, drawn-out affairs accompanied by music, dancing, and lots of toasting with some very interesting jungle juice. And the food, oh my goodness. I particularly remember one meal that featured a giant fish that had been, that morning, harpooned in the river, wrapped up in banana leaves with all kinds of vegetables, tubers, and spices, and baked over the coals. It took hours and hours to eat that meal, but nobody was in a hurry to get any place else because we were all there. Everything was ready to go, and we were all there, and there was no place to go but spend time with each other eating. That memory came to mind when Fred Walters of Acres USA called to tell me about a new book they just brought out about transforming the family's eating habits on a, get this, modern mom's schedule. Well, and so here today we're going to pause to ask Natalie Winch, who is a mother, teacher, and author of Ditching the Drive-Thru. We're going to ask Natalie, where can we find time enough for food? Natalie, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you aboard. Now, a mother, right? Let's start with the mother part, because we all know how busy mothers are. You have how many children?
I have two children.
Two children, good. Mm-hmm. But you also have a whole bunch more children, don't you?
Yes, I'm a high school English teacher, so every year I get 150 new children.
So you're a mother with two children and 100 other children that your mother through the school year, getting them to read and write in the correct sort of way. That's an interesting one. I know it was my love, English literature and Chinese literature and whatnot. So there's a lot involved that in all of that. But where did you find time enough to write about food?
Somewhere along the line, I guess when I wasn't really paying attention, I kind of became a type A person. I would have never described myself that way prior, but about 5 summers ago, I broke my ankle, and I was forced to just sit and do nothing, and I was going out of my mind, not doing anything, and my husband said, you know, why don't you write that book you've always talked about writing? And I was just like, oh, yeah, like that's a diversion and a distraction. So I did. I wrote the book while I couldn't do anything else.
And why a book about food?
Food's always been kind of important to my husband and I. We both really liked cooking even before we met. I started preserving food about 20 years ago. I picked up a copy of Stocking Up by Rodale Press on a bargain book table. And the first day of school, teachers always have these meetings. And so rather than paying attention in the meetings, I was reading this book about canning. I had never canned a thing ever in my life. And by the time I got out to field hockey practice, that there was a field hockey coach, I was like, oh, you know what, this weekend I'm going to try to can some tomatoes. So I went to this local farm and I got some tomatoes and I started cooking them down. And then I was like, oh, like I need to go get equipment. So I went to this store and I got canning jars and a hot water bath canner and came home and I canned tomatoes all day and I was wiped out. Like, I don't know how women back in the day could take care of a home with no appliances or anything like
really?
That.
Really? Isn't it it's you know, amazing to think about? My grandmother showed me her root cellar once. I have a right. photograph of it. It's just absolutely filled with all of these mason jars with all different right. colors of fruits and vegetables and preserves. It's beautiful.
Yeah. And so that's kind of what got me started. My husband was always kind of into food and cooking. So his parents, as nutty as this sounds, I guess it doesn't sound any nuttier than any of the other stuff we do. His parents always got their beef from a farmer in Minnesota. He's from Minnesota. And his parents would bring us a side of beef every year at Christmas time. They would drive out with a side of beef in their trunk, all cut up and butchered,
sure,
you know,
sure.
and frozen. And so when the farmer retired, we didn't have a source for beef. So we got some grocery store beef, and, of course, it didn't taste nearly as good. And then we paid 10 times more at a butcher store, and it still wasn't as good. And at that point, the Internet was starting to be, you know, the Internet right. with a lot of information on it. And I found eatwild.com,
mm-hmm.
where we found all kinds of farms that were closer to us that were producing grass-fed beef. And that's what started our education with all of this, and we started dealing directly with farmers. And we found a source for beef, and then we found a CSA, and then, you know, as we learned more, we realized we needed to learn more, and it just became this.
Yeah, a hungry for knowledge then, right?
Right, exactly, exactly.
Well, you came from a place, both of you, sounds like you both came from places, from homes in which food was an important part of everyday life. Not so much kids anymore. Now, you're teaching a class on food to the high school kids. Do they come from the same place that you did?
Well, I need to clarify a little bit. I'm an English teacher. I'm not teaching
right.
a food class. The politics of food unit that I teach is just one unit
right,
that
right.
we do within the school year, and it's a course that's taught in conjunction with a history class.
Oh, okay.
So they have an English teacher one period, and then they have a history teacher another period, and we kind of coordinate the things that we're doing. So it's much more of a, like, humanities-oriented
mm-hmm.
sort of a class. So they're approaching food not just from the eating standpoint, but from a social standpoint, economic, historical. Right. Like, they get all these kind of bigger picture things that are surrounding it.
But do those kids share that same history that you do, that you and your husband did, the same homestead mentality where, you know, you buy food from a farmer? Or are they city kids without that?
Completely different. And my history of food, I mean, I grew up in a traditional kind of conservative Jewish home. We kept kosher. But my mom, you know, bought food at the grocery store. Mm-hmm. I think the big difference was that, you know, I grew up in the 60s and early 70s. You know, my husband also grew up in the 60s. And I think it has more to do with that. I'm a suburban kid,
mm-hmm.
and my students are suburban kids. You know, so when we share that common ground, but it's, you know, it's 45 years later, and the context has completely shifted and how people see food. I mean, my mom, we drank Tang and we ate Quisp cereal and, you know, all
sure, sure.
good enough for the astronauts. It was good enough for us. Right.
Right.
So, it's different in that there wasn't as much convenience food or there wasn't as mm-hmm. much fast food. You know, my mom worked outside the home and she had a meal for us every night on the table.
Well, I guess what I was really looking at right there. Your mom had dinner at the table, 6 o'clock, ready to go, and families ate together then. And I guess mm-hmm. my question about the school kids is, do the families still eat together?
I find that fewer and fewer of the families eat together. I think for some of my students, for actually for a lot of my students, if they're in a two-parent home, both parents are working. Sometimes they're working two jobs, a lot of shift work and that kind of thing. So the kids are preparing meals, and they're preparing meals for younger siblings. They're in a completely different context that way.
So there, and now we're going in search of time enough for food. By golly, we have the author of Driving, Ditching the Drive-Thru. And if that isn't the perfect metaphor for modern times, the drive-thru, it's almost like going to church with an armored suit and pulling up to the window and getting your nourishment, and there you are. And we're going to talk about ditching the drive-thru with Natalie Winch, the author of Ditching the Drive-Thru. Just out from Acres USA. And so what about it out there? Do you folks have time for food? 831-479-1080. Give us a call.
Get this. You can earn a 5-6 or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at metrofarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high value specialty crops for the city at metrofarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at metrofarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at metrofarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-6 or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at metrofarm.com. That's metrofarm.com.
Well, folks, we do live in a very, very advanced civilization, do we not? Oh, we've been to the moon, we fly around the world, and yet we don't eat very civilized. We just mostly grab and gobble and run. And got to thinking, where else in the world do people eat with such hurry? Why are we in such a hurry? So when the opportunity came to talk about a book entitled Ditching the Drive-Thru, I thought if there is ever a metaphor for modern times, it's the drive-thru. And so how do we ditch the drive-thru? How do we find time enough for food, time enough to eat with our families and friends, time enough to prepare good foods? That's the question on the table today with Natalie Winch. Natalie, before we go to foods themselves, I'd like to continue with the kids for a minute. You're a school teacher teaching about the politics of food to the kids. What exactly do you mean by politics of food?
We talk about politics all throughout the year. Like, they're currently reading Richard III, so we're going to talk about politics of politics. And for me, the definition of politics is looking at power relationships. So we're looking at the power relationships when in terms of food. Who's in control of what? Why do things happen the way they do? So we talk about, like, the commodity chain, or we talk about ecological impacts or financial impacts or kind of whatever they're interested in. It takes a different shape every year, just depending on what the students are showing interest in.
Mm-hmm. I have a clever trick that you might like to use on your students. I developed it I occasionally get asked to talk about food to school kids. And so I took using two eggs. Well, one I got from the farmer's market. The other I get from the supermarket, the cheapest egg I could find. And I take a saucer for each and an egg, and I take it into class, and I hold up the eggs, and I say, can you students tell me which egg is which? And they look at the eggs, and no, they both look like an egg, right? Mm-hmm. And so then I talk about how each egg was produced and how the supermarket egg comes from a really high technology, big, huge, giant farm. And that farm has all kinds of people who know just exactly how much to feed the chicken and not feeding it one little bit too much so you don't waste money. Yeah, on the other hand, the farmer from the farmer's market does not have that ability. So that farmer must feed the chicken a little bit too much so it stays healthy. And so what do you think the eggs are going to look like? And I talk about what goes into the egg will be seen in the egg. So we crack open each egg and put it in the saucer, and the kids come up and look at it, and they can tell in a second which egg came from the farmer's market, which one came from the supermarket. Because the supermarket egg is laying flat. It's
right.
Pale yolk. It's watery. The shell is thin. The farmer's market egg is standing up proudly. Deep, rich, yellow yolk and a real thick shell. And kids can just sit there and they see exactly the difference in the eggs. And that has a way of really opening up their eyes. So you could steal that if you want.
I have done something similar. We keep chickens.
Ah, so there you go.
I brought in a day old, like an egg from yesterday that got laid yesterday. And then I borrowed an egg from the cooking room.
There you go.
Yeah, and we inspected the eggs.
Could they see the difference?
Absolutely. They could see the difference right away. They could, you know, I figure which one's fresher. And then we talked about the numbers on the egg carton, between the Julian calendar number and the Gregorian calendar number that are on there. So they know this one is when it was boxed, and this one is when it's good until. So that we understood the shelf life of an egg is actually very long, as long as it's kept under the correct circumstances.
And there you are.
Yeah.
So let's turn to our food and what happened to our food. The one thing you can say about the food of modern times is that it has become very convenient.
Very.
I mean, almost too convenient, given how we're starting to look, I guess. But very convenient. So is there anything wrong with that?
I don't know if there's anything wrong with convenience, except that we've become a culture of convenience. We want everything right away. We want results right away. I think we see in the education system, people not really willing to work for things. They're just looking at results. People are looking at end results of data rather than a process. When you're teaching writing, you start off with a rough draft and you go visions, and there's a process involved before you have a lovely final product. And I think the same thing, kind of looking at our work ethic, we're not worried about what the process is anymore. We're just worried about what the end result looks like. And the same thing comes with our food. We don't worry about the process or what it took to get there. We're just worried about, oh, it's on my plate and it looks okay and it tastes okay. So
and so all that went into that process becomes insignificant because we don't have to think about it. We just go through the drive-thru. It gets plopped into our lap, and we eat it on the run, right?
Right. There it is. We don't worry about the commodity chain, how far away it was. Like, none of those things are relevant because I was hungry. Now I have my food, and it's all good, you know, and drive away.
Mm-hmm. But is it all good?
No, it's not all good. And I want that one of the biggest problems that we run into is people are like, oh, yeah, you know what? I understand fast food is really bad for me. I'm not going to eat fast food anymore. I'm going to just have a 180-degree turnaround, and starting today, I'm just going to be really healthy, and I'm going to make all my own food. And they don't understand the incredible time commitment that change entails.
Mm-hmm.
And so after a week, it's like, oh, you know what? I don't have time for that. I don't have time for anything else. All I'm doing is making food all the time. So forget that. And they're back going through the drive-thru later.
Yeah, isn't that the crux of the issue, Natalie? It takes 2.5 incomes to maintain one household, and that means that the working adults are, you know, always behind the eight ball, and the kids are sitting in the house hungry, and then convenience really becomes an important thing, right?
Correct. And I emphasize in the book that any kind of changes that anybody's going to make, and it doesn't matter if it has to do with food or fitness or just your attitude about life, things need to happen slowly. You can't make 180-degree drastic changes and have them stick. Right? One of the teachers at my school is a psychology teacher, and she said that, you know, it takes 3 weeks to create or break a habit.
3 weeks?
3 weeks. of practiced, you know, doing something over and over again until you can make that into a habit or to break that habit. And the same thing kind of holds true with food. So in the book, one of the appendices is a 30-month plan, which seems like kind of a long time. It's 2.5 years. But to make one small change, to map it out, 30 steps to get to where you want to be, if you're only working on one thing in a given month, it gives you that time to develop that as a habit, and then it can move on to the next step.
So you're talking about making 30 different changes.
Correct.
Over 30 months.
Right, over 30 months.
So giving yourself 2.5 years to essentially change the way you live entirely.
You can, or you know, you can. It could be about anything. Like, you know, so many people are looking for jobs. They're underemployed right now. So maybe they have a 30-month plan that they're going to put in place to get themselves employed at a level they should be. What are the things that you need to do? So it could apply to anything, not just food.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we better start by taking step number one when we get back from this break, and we'll change our lives. We're starting right now. I'm ready to go. Especially when it comes to enjoying food and the conviviality of enjoying food with family and friends. The big tragedy of the drive-thru, right? We put these steel cocoon around ourselves, and we charge through the drive-in, and they throw food out the window at us, and we drive off with a lap full of food, and boy, we're certainly missing something there. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Natalie Winch, the author of Driving, Ditching the Drive-Thru. Do stay tuned, right back. Well, to make a really big change, you got to make a really big change, and it's got to start someplace. So the first step is, do you have to become really aware of why you need to make that change? Is that a fair assumption, Natalie?
I think people make these kinds of changes for all different reasons. Some make them for health reasons, you know, or for just feeling like they're missing out on family life. Or, you know, just because they've read that GMOs are bad for you, so they suddenly want to avoid GMOs.
And there you go. Let's pick up Wendy, who's got a comment on apathy, which I'm curious to hear. Wendy, welcome to The Food Chain. We've got Natalie Winch, author of Ditching the Drive-Thru.
Well, Natalie, I think you are on a wonderful crusade, and I wonder how to, if there's a way to convince these CEOs who have to work for their stockholders' benefit, and they often think of benefit as being, you know, profit, but when they're destroying the entire way we consume food, how can we get to the stockholder level and convince them that it's for their benefit to try to make the entire food chain better? Because even if you try to do it by yourself, they have lawyers who are going after everyone who tries to do something better.
You know, there's an interesting thing right happening in the news right now, Wendy, about the stockholders of the Valent Corporation that manufactures drugs, and the stockholders of Coca-Cola. And of course, we know what they make. And the Valent people says, sugar is bad for you. Coca-Cola is destroying the world. And the Coca-Cola people say, those drugs are really bad for you. So they're destroying the world, too. So just an interesting comment with respect to stockholders of a big food company. Well, let's ask Natalie, what about it? Natalie, what about the stockholders or people who own those big food companies? Is there a way of whipping them into shape?
Well, it's a real David versus Goliath kind of a thing. And if we think about it in terms of David and Goliath, Goliath was a big giant who didn't have a great vision. And David was small and mobile, so he was able to kind of outmaneuver Goliath and bring him down. And I think we need to kind of approach it that way. I think that middle class America, the average person, has a little more power than they think they do. And that is in their wallets. They track everything that you buy. If you have one of those shopper cards that you're getting the good price on, everything that goes across that scanner, they know exactly how you shop. That's how they know which coupons they should print out or send to you, because these are the kinds of things that you may purchase based on your past purchases. Keeping that in mind, then, it's supply and demand. So if the average consumer is demanding a certain kind of product, we're going to see more of that product and less of products that we're not demanding.
You like to use literary allusions in your book, Sisyphus versus Zeus. So how does that conflict work out?
We are always going to be kind of up against the Joel Salatin's favorite metaphor was with the Cyclops, corporate food as a Cyclops.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole Odyssey metaphor going on because the book is kind of a following of my personal Odyssey through food and for my family, the Odyssey that we went through. And I think that the little guy can win. I mean, it feels like we're not getting where, and it feels like we're not getting anywhere. But in fact, there are small changes. The fact that Monsanto had to spend so much money in the campaign in California in order to fight the GMO labeling lets you know that they're afraid. You know, in a sense, they've tipped their hand, that they're fearful that this might happen.
Yeah, it was $100 million to convince us that we shouldn't know about the GMOs in the food. It would indicate they have some kind of emotions at risk there, right?
Right, that's a lot of money,
yeah.
Even for a big corporation.
So what about Sisyphus? Where does Sisyphus come into the equation?
I think that a lot of times that's what our lives feel like. I think we feel like we are constantly rolling that rock up the hill and not getting any place with it. And as soon as you think you're making a little bit of progress, something else comes along to bog you down. Mm-hmm. The week that I had this week, our grades were due this week, and then it was National Honor Society induction. So I had kids coming to me with speeches that needed to be revised, and then they needed to rehearse their speeches, and I'm still trying to get my grades done, and kids are coming in with late work, and it's like one thing after another, after another, after another. And I think that most people's lives are kind of that way, the unanticipated problems or, you know, suddenly you have to stay late at work and you weren't anticipating that and you have to get your child to piano lessons or soccer practice or whatever. We have things that pull us in so many directions. And every time it feels like we're making a little bit of progress, we get thrown a curveball, and those curveballs seem to send us, you know, rolling backwards down the hill again.
Mm-hmm. And what about Zeus?
Zeus is the omnipotent God, but he has his undoings. Like there are ways that he's manipulated all through mythology, and he's got a bad temper, and he's got a lot of wrath that needs to be dodged. And I think that it shows us that, you know, there is a little bit of power that we can have, but that we need to be careful as well.
Amen to that, because if Zeus gets pissed at you, you're in big trouble, right?
Oh, big time, yeah.
You know, in thinking about the change that, you know, just as long as I've been talking about food and writing about it and whatnot, a tremendous change in the perception of our food. And it's a blessing to see because, like you say, you often think that you're getting nowhere. You feel like Sisyphus, but you know, if you look in the broad landscape of things, like you say, there's been huge changes made. You look at the fix that Monsanto is in right now, and I think its stock is down like 25% here.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the fact that people are starting to say, "Well, I don't want to eat that corn or that soybean," and that's having an impact on the farmers that buy seeds, you know. That so it's life is changing. There is a way to fight, but have to be careful because they have a lot of money to fight with, and they have the ability to impact government, which
correct.
Of course explains how Michael Taylor, former Monsanto vice president, is now the food safety czar of the United States.
Correct.
So there you go. So Zeus is pretty powerful.
Yeah.
So when we come back from this break that we're going to take, I'd like to start off by how on earth we find the time to change our approach to food so that We can be more like those primitive people in the primeval forest of the Amazon that have lots of time to enjoy their meals and make their meals, you know, the focal point of their world, as opposed to driving through the drive-thru and grabbing and gobbling and running like we do. There have to be some major changes, and we're going to ask Natalie Winch where to start. Where do you start out there? 831-479 is the phone number today. How do you find time enough for food and family and friends? 831-479-1080, this is the Food Chain, the radio show. And we're talking with Natalie Winch, the author of Ditching the Drive-Thru. As an English teacher, would it be authoress or author?
Author, just like actor.
Okay, good to go. Right back. Okay, folks, here we go. We are going to ditch the drive-thru with Natalie Winch, who is the author of Ditching the Drive-Thru. Natalie, where do we start? Step number one in the 30-month process.
I can't prescribe what people should do because everybody has a different life, a different context, a different set of parameters that they need to deal with. And I say that over and over again. I mean, it's about empowering yourself. You know yourself best. You know your family best. You know your situation best. So it's a matter of first looking at what your priorities are. I mean, if you're going back to school and you're taking classes at night, what's more important, getting your degree finished or sitting down with your family? Or if people are working shift work, obviously they need to go to work. They can't say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm not coming in today because I need to have dinner with my family. But I think if we look at a broader view, not necessarily saying, oh, I need to sit down and eat with my family 7 nights a week, I think most people would have a really difficult time making that happen. We don't make that happen. We can't sit down together 7 nights a week. Our schedule is not that that fluid. It's not that regular.
Especially when it takes 2.5 incomes to make one household, right?
Correct.
It's really tough on everybody.
Right.
But so the first step then really is taking a look in the mirror and seeing who you are and seeing what your priorities are. And then step number two.
What's the important thing that you need to do? Mm-hmm. So if you feel as though it's most important to not eat so much fast food, then maybe the for the next month you're going to look at not having pizza every Friday. You're going to try to do something else. Do you know what I mean? Like have a meal that you cook ahead and
kind of challenging yourself, right?
Right. And that's what it's about. A friend of mine used to always say, life is about choices. You always have a choice. Even when it feels like you don't have a choice, you usually do. It's just that we don't want to deal with the consequences of, do you know what I mean? The not easy choice.
Right.
There are consequences. Everything that you do, there's a consequence. So if we're eating easy food, there's a consequence to the easy food. But as far as sitting down together as a family for a meal, most people, I think, tremble when they think about that because the times that they sit down to eat family meals are like Thanksgiving, which is right around the corner.
Right.
Huge production kind of meal. It's turkey and it's stuffing and it's this and it's that. It's all these things that take a really long time to make. If we approach it a little more simply, that you don't have to have this, you know, a big deal kind of a meal. It could be something much simpler. Then maybe it's not quite so scary.
There
and then
you go.
It doesn't have to be dinner on Wednesday night. Maybe everybody is home at lunchtime on Sunday. So maybe everybody gets together and has a meal together once a week at lunchtime on Sunday.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like finding where the opportunity is and exploiting that opportunity then.
Correct.
And there you go. And if you can find that opportunity, and there are always opportunities, but just finding them. You know, the big frightening thing is the amount of time it takes to prepare a home-cooked meal and to enjoy it. And yet, it takes time to go through the drive-thru, too, if you think about it. And it's not all that much more time if you prepare, you know, yourself to prepare food than it does to drive through the drive-thru. We recently did a radio show with a food service. They send you food. It's not prepared, but all the real raw ingredients are there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've seen ads on TV for that.
it truly is amazing. Everything comes in a box. Mm-hmm. We have six meals, you know, so that my wife and I have a meal apiece 3 nights a week. And it takes, you know, maybe 20 minutes to prepare everything. And these are the kind of dishes that, you know, you probably, I couldn't find them in a restaurant around here. They're absolutely incredible. And it only took 20 minutes. Zoom, it's done. And I'm thinking, well, how much time would I have saved by going through a drive-thru? Maybe 3 minutes or something like that when it gets right down to it. And what this service really provided was, you know, the thought, the thinking. They said, this is what you're going to do. Here's the materials, and the rest is easy. So I'm not sure time is all that much if we're prepared. What do you think?
Preparation and the planning, I mean, it's just like anything. Preparation and planning is probably 90% of the stumbling block for a lot of people. I think a lot of people are intimidated by the kitchen. One of the comments that I make in the book is that cooking is kind of, or I think Joel said it first in the foreword, that cooking has become kind of a spectator sport. We watch it on TV with all the cooking shows and the cooking competition shows, and those kinds of things are so popular now. But the preparation, just thinking ahead and, you know, what's coming up this week and, you know, what can we eat? And I'll cook on Sunday afternoon and I'll have like meals good to go for, you know, 4 or 5 days when it's my week to cook. I cook in advance because I don't have as much time.
So planning.
Yeah.
We're going to take a last break. When we come back, we're going to talk about your favorite foods to prepare that don't take a lot of time and have a way of bringing your family together. The foods that you like to prepare, foods that your husband likes to eat, and foods that your children enjoy eating as well. There's all kinds of interests going on in that one. We will be right back. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Natalie Winch, and you do stay tuned. Well, folks, we do live in a very advanced civilization here in the United States of America, Western Europe, here, there, and everywhere. But, boy, we're sure not eating very civilized. We put ourselves in these big, huge iron cases, and we drive through the drive-through, and they throw food at us out the window, and it lands in our lap, and we drive off eating French fries and whatnot, and there it goes. It just seems so primitive almost, and yet when you look at primitive people, they spend a lot of time eating and procuring food and thinking about food and how it brings them together in community and family, and that's something we're seem to be missing in the modern world, is that closeness that eating together and preparing our foods together brings us together. Natalie Winch, gosh, what do you do to cook? You're a very busy person. You're a working mother, a school teacher, an author, a teacher. You're always busy. So what do you do? How do you cook your food? What do you prepare for your family that they love to eat?
I think the thing that my family loves to eat the most that I make is meatloaf. So when I'm
the ultimate comfort food, right?
Right, right. Meatloaf, and we like baked potatoes with a ton of butter and sour cream in it, and a salad. Like, that's just a family favorite. And so when I'm making meatloaf, I'll make 2 or even 3 while everything's dirty from making the meatloaf, and I'll bake all 3 of them, and then I'll put 2 of them in the freezer and pre-slice them. So then when it's like, oh, geez, you know,
need something quick, there's some real food.
Right, right. You can take those slices out, and you can just lay them on a baking sheet and pop them in the oven, and they're ready in like 15 minutes, frozen to on the plate.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
What else? I'm hungry already. What else do we do?
Oh, my kids love taco casserole. That's on my website, tradsnotfads.com. The recipe for that, they love that. And that's another one that I'll make double, and I'll put one in the freezer. It freezes really nicely.
So already in taking that one simple step, we're thinking ahead, right?
Mm-hmm. That's correct. That's
and
correct.
We're planning. So in just in something so simple as making extra meatloaf, we're starting to plan ahead and think ahead, which is what, 90% of the whole process?
Yes, I would definitely say that. I mean, if we look at primitive cultures, you keep talking about primitive cultures, they bond over their food because they're challenged.
Yep.
To find food in order to prepare. And so when we're faced with challenges and we're trying to overcome a challenge with somebody else, we bond over that challenge. And I think the challenge of trying to plan our meals will help us bond with our family. If it's not just me planning the meals, it's my husband and I planning the meals, and my children and my husband and I all planning the meals together, that we face this challenge as a family. And that's part of what helps us to bond. It's not just the eating together part of it, but the preparation and the planning as well.
Yeah, you know, I mentioned that dinner I enjoyed on the Amazon, and if they killed the fish that morning, you know, they harpooned it in the river, drug mm-hmm. it ashore, cleaned it, took the scales off of it, wrapped it up in banana leaves with a bunch of vegetables and whatnot, and there it was, absolutely delicious. Natalie Winch, thank you so much for joining us. Ditching the Drive-Thru from Acres USA. You can also get William Albrecht's collected papers at Acres USA, so check that out as well. Thank you all for tuning in. Remember Michael's second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in that food. Thank you, Natalie.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.